Perfect. First of all, no, we.
So thank you very much. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming to the CSG meeting. We have with us Goran and Cyrus. Thank you very much for taking the time, and Becky, sorry, to be with us today. So what I would propose that is that maybe if you agree, Goran, you can start if you have any comments to share with us. You can start with that, and then, as you know, the three constituencies will be asking each one question to start with, and then we'll engage in the debate if that's fine for you.
I mean, this usually becomes very interesting. So why don't we start with questions? I think that's easy.
Sure, we can do that. So we will go to the round robin, and we will start with the IPC, ISPCP, and then with the BC. From the IPC standpoint, Brian and Alex, I don't know who will go first.
Thank you so much. Actually, do you mind if we could defer and go second? Would that be possible?
Tony, is that fine for you to start?
It's my voice speaking, so as a chair, I can hand over to Tony. I'm confident he knows what to say.
Okay, so you kindly invited questions. And one of the things that we've been discussing in the constituency, followed on from yesterday's meeting of the CCWG on internet governance, and we certainly commend ICANN for their efforts in getting some form of early warning of issues that are at the political level that are likely to impact the ICANN environment. And I think that's a really good initiative. The surprise we had was when we looked at the charter that's going to underpin the follow-on operations from that, it appears that the responsibility for input back, which will help make sure everyone's aware of ICANN's mission and the facts of any matter they're relating, seems to come down to ICANN.org rather than looping back in through the community. There doesn't appear to be a community loop in there, which is a concern because I think that the strength of ICANN is its multi-stakeholder environment, and through that environment and that engagement, you get a lot of additional information. So has any thought been given to that?
I actually don't really understand, because the whole charter is about to be transparent and have community engagement in it. Am I missing the point?
Well, if you look at I think there were three.
Remember,
steps,
I'm Swedish, yeah. And it's still before 12 o'clock, so I'm not waking up yet.
We haven't got the charter up, but there were three elements to the charter, three follow-on actions that could be taken. They all appeared to be focused towards actions taken by ICANN.org without a community loop in there. So the intelligence, I think, is a really useful thing to have. Advanced warning is always good. But the actions that can follow on to actually make sure that the awareness of ICANN, its role, how it operates, and how it would be impacted didn't appear to have any form of community discussion.
The reason why we did a charter for comments is to get comments so we can have. I mean, it's a transparency charter, really, to make sure that the community knows what we are doing and can have an input to it. So that's the sort of intention of bringing down a charter. If you have specific proposals how to make that happen in a positive way, that's why we ask you for comments.
Okay, thank you. So we will send some comments back on that.
I'm looking forward to it.
If I can follow on from another aspect of that discussion as well. I believe there is a discussion with regards to ICANN engagement in other forums as well, one of which is within the ITU as well. And the question that we had there, in fact, two questions. One is, what does ICANN believe it will actually achieve by becoming a member of the ITU that it can't do now? And the second question is, has there been any risk assessment done on what that could possibly mean for ICANN in the longer term?
We are participating in ITU today under the flag of, for instance, organizations like RIPE and ISOC. And it's actually, if you turn it around, why should we, ICANN, which you are a part of, you are ICANN, not be able to stand with his own flag in an international forum, but have to stand with someone else and have to be asked permission for asking them to convey what we believe in is our mission. There's a lot of history in this one, and maybe I'm not know all the history, but I've been active in ITU, and I've seen sort of embarrassment, actually, that ICANN as an institution doesn't perceive itself as being as strong as ISOC and RIPE, for instance, or the other RERs who actually are there already. The reason why we choose ITUD is actually because we have friends in ITUT. We don't have to go there as well. ITUD is about, some of the things is in the ICANN DNA, which is about connecting more people to the internet itself, which I happen to believe in personally. It's a very good thing. So when it comes to risk assessments, sometimes it seems to be perception that the ITU actually have powers. It's the countries within the ITU that have powers. And you know as well as I do that in the ITU fora, countries meets and talks about things that definitely has an impact on ICANN. And as I said in my opening speech yesterday, I happen to believe ICANN as an institution is fairly good at making certain types of decisions. And I think that to some extent are better than qualified in governments, and I think it's important for us to stand up and have that opinion also within the ITU. And as I said to someone else, yeah, worst thing, we can leave. They cannot take us over because we're members.
If I may just come back on that. I think part of the concern is that we would really look on ICANN as an institution that is in its own environment, the equivalent of the ITU. Yet becoming a sector member of the ITU doesn't place ICANN at that level. In fact, it places ICANN way down the stack as a sector member, because at all of the major conferences where ICANN may want to express a view, you can't do that. It's governments that are at the table, not sector members. So the issue is, what does ICANN gain that it couldn't actually achieve through being part of the ITUD as a partnership arrangement rather than as a sector member?
First of all, correction. ITU is a member here. They have an observer status in the GAC. And we are sort of doing the same thing with them now, so I think that we're equal. And in honest, I would actually say that it feels a little bit strange for me to say that in any way we would, by joining ITU, become under them. Well, we are what we are. But the fact of the matter is that the governments around the world would not go away. ITU and the UN will exist, I think, for a fair long time. We have received very positive reactions from many parts of the community about this, and a bigger understanding that ICANN has to take sometimes to fight where it actually happens. In the ITU, where I think I met you, by the way, in Dubai, was it interesting? Who did you represent?
I represented the UK government.
UK government. So many of us actually go to ITU meetings. And this time it was the first time ever ICANN was presented on its own flag when I was invited on the stage by the Secretary General. Actually, this is the first time ever any organization or country which is not the host country, was standing up on stage during the opening ceremony. That was a great respect from the ITU staff and the Secretary General for ICANN as an institution and an organization. We need to work where we have to meet organizations that we can defend the multi-stakeholder model. And I happen to believe that ICANN is strong enough as an institution not to be feeling that we're in second place anywhere. And it was nice meeting you there and some other of you.
Thank you. We need now to move to the IPC. Alex or Brian?
Thank you so much, Claudia. This is Brian Winterfeld for the record, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dean Marks, who's going to ask our first question.
Hi there. Thanks, Dean Marks, for the record. Actually, this is a little bit more of a statement because there's been some questions that have been asked to the IPC about their participation in the EPDP. So I just wanted to, in this public forum, read a statement to sort of clarify our outlook and intentions moving forward. And that's that the IPC looks forward to participating productively in the work of phase two of the EPDP. We believe this critical work must be given the same level of support from ICANN.org and the board as was the phase one work, and needs to be subject to timeframes and deadlines as the phase one work. We think it would be most productive and efficient to divide the work of phase two into at least two separate work streams. The first work stream should address the policies around access and a unified access model, and should, as a priority, identify the different categories of legitimate third-party interests that will be incorporated into an accreditation system as part of the UAM. The second work stream should address the questions and issues that were left unresolved and carried over from phase one to phase two, such as the legal natural person registrant distinction. We believe work can effectively and efficiently be accomplished on these two work streams by forming separate work groups within the EPDP team. In addition, we support the continued work of the technical study group on access to non-public registration data, and think that this group's work so far has added both substantive value and efficiency in working towards the goal of a unified access model. We appreciate that there are legal questions about access to redacted WHOIS data, about potentially drawing up and submitting codes of conduct related to access in the UAM, about the liability risks for contracted parties, and about the role of ICANN as a controller or joint controller with respect to the UAM. We stand ready to work with the community and our colleagues in the EPDP team, as well as ICANN.org, to address these types of issues. Moreover, we also stand ready to work with our colleagues in ALAC, ESSAC, and the GAC to address the various concerns and issues that they have raised in their statements about the work of the EPDP, and we share their concerns that policy development and implementation around access to redacted WHOIS data must be given as much attention, work, support, and urgency as the work that was undertaken to reach the phase one final report recommendations. Thanks.
So I just want to say on behalf of the board that thank you for that statement, but also the board is deeply committed to supporting phase two. We know that org is equally committed to supporting phase two. That work is critically important work, and so we have been very happy to receive these kinds of indications also from the registry stakeholder group said that it was committed to participating to working towards an expeditious completion, and we expect all members of the community to come to the table in that spirit. Just so you understand, ICANN.org has not sat idly by and is trying to move the ball down the field here. The technical study group work that Joran initiated and that has had good results and that we're all looking at and thinking about now, discussions with contracted parties consistent with the recommendations in the EPDP to understand roles and responsibilities have been commenced. you know, I can sort of putting aside the mechanism, the UAM mechanism, there are implementation and compliance issues that ICANN has begun to think about and start thinking about. I particularly appreciated your recognition about the legal issues and the complications here, because we are quite aware of some dependencies that affect the UAM, and that really is the how can you get to a uniform, consistent, predictable experience for users of that data. And there are two ways to do it. One, you could get clarity from the data protection authorities about, you know, the rules, who gets access to what data, under what circumstances, for what purposes, and with what safeguards. So I sort of call those the who, what, why, where, when questions. And you could take those and get legal clarity from the European Data Protection Board, remember, or from a court. Can't be just one data protection authority, because they don't speak for all of them. ORG has been engaged in conversations with the data protection authorities groups from the beginning, and that is a path we expect they will pursue. But frankly, no one should be over optimistic about the likelihood that that is going to produce results. The second path for a UAM is to take the mechanism, the UAM technical model that the TSG has put together, with some inputs on who's going to identify and authenticate users of the system, and say, who European Data Protection Board will you look to? Who is going to be liable for data that's processed through there? That's another way that we could get to a predictable. So there now, ideally you'd get both and it would be wonderful, but no one is sufficiently naive to think that that is going to be easy. But that is the path that the board certainly wants ORG to take, and my understanding, you can look at Joran, that's what they are going to pursue diligently. Meanwhile, there's going to be as much support. There's no flagging in support from the board or ORG on phase two. And I just think we do need to step back a little bit, because I've heard some people say the pace for phase one was not sustainable. I don't think we should automatically think that means they are saying we're going to slow roll phase two. We expect that not to be the case, and we will be clear about that expectation. But let's not jump to the conclusion that because the pace of phase one, which I think probably was brutal for those of you who were involved in the three-hour calls a week kind of thing, maybe it can't be three-hour calls a week, but it obviously has to move along expeditiously and with a sense of urgency. And just the final thing on time frames, a couple of people have raised this with me. I think, you know, ultimately, the board can express a hope, a strong hope, that the group work within timelines, but that is up to the PDP charter to establish those. So, in case I said anything wrong.
No.
Thank you.
Can I add that there is, on the timeline, I'm probably the first one to say it's very hard to set a timeline. On the simple reason, we can't. I mean, if we have a lot of things to work, to be able to do, to be able to get answers from many DPAs. And again, I remember, I think it was a year ago, we had a fantastically interesting meeting here with some of you were actually shouting at me and saying you will have no guidance from the DPAs. And it was hard work to get the DPAs advice the first time. Now we're actually asking them to to go back and look at what they said before and come up with another solution to the answering to the question we answer. So we actually asked them to look at something completely in a different way. And that's even harder than we did before. So our internal, you can't make an omelet without breaking the eggs. And to be able to have a unified access model, we have to diminish the contracting parties' legal responsibilities. And until we got that act together with all the questions we have to ask the DPAs, which we are doing with the European Commission based on the work on the technical group, then we can go and ask. We don't know if we're actually going to get an answer. If you go into any DPA's webpage, they will say, we are not a consultancy company. They don't give advice. And advice in this matter is not an advice. It is something that, what's her name yesterday said, it's not legally binding. It has a legal value because it means that the other DPAs cannot make another decision than the decision that comes out of the Data Protection Board. So it will be the same decision from all DPAs in all the countries. So it has a big legal value inside the scene. And you know, when we have the technical study group, we worked very deliberately during 3 months. The next step of that is to connect that with the accreditation houses, for instance, WIPO or Europol or whatever they're building, and to build that whole framework together. And then go to ask the European Commission if they can help us. And we didn't do this by chance. We actually had conversations with them before we started this work. And then when we formulate that, we have to go with the questions to the DPAs. And then maybe we get an answer. So that's why I'm saying it's very hard to set a timeline for the phase two if the expectation of the phase two is to come up with a unified access model. And I said this before, and I'm going to say this again, the whole intent of the law is to give liabilities to the ones who collect the data, process the data, and that is, in our world, the contracted parties. Thank you. I hope I lowered your expectations too sufficiently enough.
I'm sorry, Alex, but we have a few minutes, so I need also the BC to thank you.
Actually, I can give you three, four extra minutes if you want to have a follow-up question, because this is probably important.
Thank you.
We're going in the same direction, Joran. Then, first of all, when we met in Barcelona, you wanted to know whether the community felt it was appropriate to move to a UAM. And we all went to the mic and delivered. The day after, you delivered on a promise to set up a technical study group, which was a bit of a surprise, and a better surprise because here we are several months later and the technical study group finished the job. And so the first thing I want to do is acknowledge that the TSG, and Chantel is going to display that slide that we used yesterday, the TSG confirmed, I know you don't, the TSG confirmed that cycle can work technically. And most didn't have any doubt about that, but it's fabulous to have it confirmed that way. So the I think it reminds me of the U.S. Navy Construction Brigade, or CB. Their slogan is the difficult we do right away, and the impossible takes a little longer. So I'm turning you for the impossible part, which is, can you commit that ICANN.org is willing? Not that you know that you'll get the legal model, but are you willing to step into the role, the appropriate controller role in the right-hand side of that diagram, to be able to make the UAM work legally? And I realize you cannot predict whether that's joint controller, co-controller, so-controller. That'll have to get figured out. What we are looking for is a firm commitment that you're willing to take whatever responsibility is necessary to make that work. Thank you.
It's not up to us to make that decision. That's the whole point we've been trying to say. We went out 2017 in August and said we had some sort of controllership. We have said with the hub and spoke model, whatever we said, we are willing to take a role in this one. So that's besides the table. But remember, it's not up to us to make the decision. We can have an opinion. But in the final stage, it's actually the DPAs who makes that decision. They are the ones who makes that decision. We can have an ID. You and I can agree and drink champagne. I don't drink champagne, but you know what I mean. But it's actually in the hands of the DPAs and finally the court who makes that distinction. So,
and I'm trying to make a somewhat subtle question, and a simple answer is probably right there. It was the willingness of org that if the model calls for you to be some flavor of controller, from sole to code joint, would you be willing to step into those shoes? I think the answer is yes, and that's a great answer. I'll take that answer.
Yeah, but it's also we. So I let's be. I mean, let's be honest, guys. So I came in here first time. You know, I think it was Johannesburg, and I told you exactly what I'm going to do, and I done that from day one. I came up with the Calzone model. I actually invented by out of thin air a process. There are many people wanted me only to talk to the contracted parties as a compliance. And I took a lot of heat for that, but we constructed Calzone to be able for you to have an opinion. I gave you guys email addresses to the DPAs as well. Yeah. And we constructed this one based on that model with the strength of the community, who all agreed on a couple of things. Yes, it's going to be a covered model, but we need data. With that, I went to the DPAs in Europe who said, yes, you can have a WHOIS system. They didn't specify exactly what kind of information should be there, but they said you can have a system. They also said it's okay for you to have some information in public and some in private. That led to the template. And I always said that that's going to be the easiest path for you. So from the beginning, we said the same thing all the time. It's always that with reality. When you get closer and closer to the decision points, it gets harder and harder because the alternatives are fewer. I think that we have proven from ICANN.org that we want to take a role in this one. But there are certain rules we can't take. For instance, if someone wants me to take ICANN.org to be responsible of all the contracted parties' missteps, indemnification, that's not even possible. You're a non. We don't have the kind of money. Think that my board would say. be. We had to raise the price a lot. But so we always known about the problem, and we've been working on it. I set up the technical group after the contracted parties all said, yes, it's okay to enter the discussion about diminishing the contracted parties' legal responsibilities. I asked you, I asked the IPC the same question I actually asked the GAC. So we come up with new ideas how to diminish their legal responsibility. How many are lawyers in this room? Some of you. We would also look forward to your suggestions how to do it. So we have, I mean, we are looking at the technical model. We talked about there are provisions inside the GDPR for public interest, not the public interest. We are talking about there is a new cyber legislation that is enacted in April. You and I talked about that, Dean. And you also have the NIS directive. We are asking a lot of different questions to see how that could affect not only the WHOIS system, because that's only one of the thousands of databases we have. Transparency has always been a part of ICANN. So to answer your question, yes, we have said we're going to have a role, but it's very hard for us to set down this is the role we're going to have. Because in the end, if the technical model has an effect, we have sort of philosophical discussion. If you have an accreditation house, you have a hub and spoke model, and you have the contracted parties, it's probably, that's not a joint controllership. That's something completely different that is today undefined in the law. That's going to take some time to figure that out. So it's not that easy to say, I'm committing to be something, because we actually don't know what it is.
Thank you. We work for willingness, and you've indicated the willingness once again. So that's a baseline commitment, being willing to step into whatever role is necessary to take on sufficient responsibility such that we can make this model work. And for that, we're grateful. During yesterday's discussion.
I have a commitment that if we build this model that you're going to pay for it in IPC and BC.
Certainly willing. During yesterday's session, there was a split opinion about you're in the far right-hand column, this notion of getting accredited. Some of us on yesterday's panel believe that the way that Europol, Interpol, WIPO, the way any of those entities would pursue a code of conduct accreditation by the Data Protection Board is completely up to them. Some of us don't believe that has anything to do with ICANN.org or this community. On the other hand, once they do get accredited, you have to validate the credentials of the entity in order for you to be able to do the RDAP query. So what is your thinking about the role ICANN will play at defining how one gets accredited in the far right-hand column?
I mean, we came up with the idea. We use words as well as accreditation and that. And more, some of them is a legal meaning because they're actually under GDPR. So accreditation in the GDPR has a very special meaning. When we talk about accreditation in this sense, it's actually who actually do the verb, who actually accredited. That could be outside the actual definition of the law. So let's, you know, who checks that the organization behind the question is okay and makes sure that it seems like it's legal? That is outside the accreditation part of the law. In this side, I mean, right now, we're in discovery mode. Remember that the law is specific. The law doesn't, you might say that the law doesn't prevent the unified access model, but it actually does, because the law is specific about the role of the controller. On the contracted party's role. So what we're trying to do here, what I think is, you know, and I think there are some support from some of the DPAs and definitely support from many parts of the European Commission who wrote the law to investigate how this kind of work. So when we started the idea of WIPO, to have them to validate the question and validate the organization, they're going to have some sort of specific role in this one, and therefore a liability. And then this is sent to a hub and spoke model. I heard yesterday that someone thought that that should happen outside ICANN. That's a policy question for me. That's not something that we decide. Because that organization has to take the risk as well. And I don't know if any external organization would like to take that risk. I understand that in Canada, there's potential to do that on a lower risk. That's interesting. Because if you can lower the risk in the system, it's good for all of us. So you're asking a very good question. I mean, join us of helping to answer the questions. Yes, of course.
I just really want to add one piece of that. The question of who has, if there's a code of conduct and that gets done entirely by the organization that's doing the authorization, that has implications for how the liability flows all the way down. And so the answer to that question is it sort of depends on where you shift the liability. It may be that you can better shift the liability if there's agreed upon code of conduct that they haven't put together all by themselves. And so there's no definite answer to it because it's a spectrum of how and where you shift the liability, and you can shift it in one place and shift it in another. So there's no, I don't know what the answer is, but there's no fixed answer at this point.
I think all lawyers understand. I don't.
Well, thank you very much for the engagement and for staying with us today. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to continue the agenda, and we have now the engagement with the SSR2 member. I don't know. I'm looking at Denise and the other. Yeah.
Hi. This engagement comes as a bit of a surprise to me, but I'm happy to speak to it, and the commercial stakeholder group also has Rep. Scott is also serves on the SSR2.
Scott is here. Yes.
All right. Take it away, Scott. I have some slides for Shaishan. Send them to Chantal.
Chantal, can you put up the slides? Thank you.
Okay, I'll just give you a quick overview, and when the slides come up, we'll make sure those are displayed and shared. The SSR2 review team, a bylaw mandated community review, is meeting extensively here in Kobe. We're in the analysis, and a little bit of fact finding is left, but we're all moving into the analysis and drafting stage, and so a lot of intensive internal work is occurring amongst the team here in Kobe. We have a work plan that with the target of providing a first draft report by Marrakesh for the community to consider. We have four work streams that the team is focused on. The first work stream is mandated by the bylaws. We have to review the implementation and assess that completion and effectiveness of the first SSR report, SSR 1. They had 28 separate recommendations. It's quite a lengthy undertaking. That has taken up a considerable amount of time. And of course, the SSR 2 team was suspended by the board for about a year. And so we're catching, we've spent this past several months catching up on work, integrating new members, and further defining our work plan. So in addition to looking at what happened with SSR 1, we have three other work streams that we're focused on. One is called ICANN SSR. That's focused on the SSR-related activities that are pretty much solely within ICANN's remit. The second work stream is DNS SSR. Those are what the team views as priority activities that that ICANN may share responsibility for, or may have a facilitation role in, or may impact SSR responsibilities of ICANN. And then the final work stream is looking at evolving SSR challenges and opportunities. I'll pause there, see if Chantel has the slides, and give Scott a chance to talk. And we're also happy to answer any questions. We had an engagement session yesterday that no one really came to, but we we were hidden away in KCC, and it conflicted with GDPR, so we're not taking it personally. Perhaps we should. We have an online email address and, of course, a wiki. Everything that we do is posted there, and we're always accessible if people or groups have specific input for us.
Are there any questions on that? Scott, do you have anything more to add to what Denise said?
No, I just second what Denise said, and I think having the timeline of getting the draft report out, we've got the face-to-face coming up in May, get the draft out by then, and have it up for public comment basically over the summer, and then issue the final report come, what's the fall meeting? Montreal? Yeah.
Yes, well, who he?
Thanks, Robert Wickholm speaking. Sorry, I don't have a question to the items you are talking about, rather than to the spirit of the team. You remember what happened the last time, in the first round of this SSR team, and then the re-establishment of that team. So, how is the spirit in the team? Do you have a feeling it's going well, or? If there are any critical things, which you see, up for the future discussions here, but it used to be in the past. Did you hear my question?
I'm sorry, I was speaking with Chantal.
Denise, my question was, with regard to the spirit in the team, remembering what happened in the past with that team. So is that going well?
I think it's going well. I think the new members appointed have been well integrated. We're largely on schedule with our work plan. And Scott?
Yeah, I'll say as a new member coming on board last, what was that, spring, I guess? I was brought up to speed very quickly. I realized there was some discord probably in the previous team as well, and that's been flushed out, so.
Okay, thank you very much. So welcome, Becky, and sorry if you waited a few minutes. Thank you very much for being with us today. And I will leave the floor to you if you have a presentation, and then we will follow up with some questions from members.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Becky Nash from the ICANN Finance Department. I wanted to first introduce my colleague, Shawnee Quidway, who is also going to be presenting with us today. And then we do have joining us as well, Xavier Calvez, our ICANN CFO. We are here today to give an update on finance activities. And to cover a very key component of the draft FY20 operating plan and budget process to focus on the public comments. So if I could just go to slide number 3, that would be helpful, the agenda. So we're going to give a short update today on FY19 financial overview, which is the current fiscal year. Then we're going to provide a high-level overview of the FY20 draft budget, which was submitted for public comment. Then we have a section to cover the public comments that were submitted. We have the public comments by theme and also by submitter. And then we want to engage on public comments submitted from the stakeholder groups represented today. Just before going into the presentation, I would just like to highlight that the finance team at ICANN has posted financial reporting on our website. So we do publish quarterly financials that are available approximately a month and a half after each quarter end. So we do encourage members to look at the financials that are posted on our website. And I also would like to advertise that on Wednesday, tomorrow, we do have a public session, which includes the finance team. It is at 9 a.m., 9 to 12. So if there are conflicts, we apologize in advance, but you can certainly come in and out of the session. It's also going to include financial updates similar to this, discussion of the public comments. We also have the planning, which is going to include the 5-year strategic planning process and the 5-year operating plan and financial plan, and also an update on the 2-year planning process that was submitted for public comment. So if we could just go to the next slide, and one more slide. Appreciate that. So the FY19 year to date, if we could advance the document down. Thank you. This is a quick snapshot of the FY19 year-to-date results, which are the first 6 months of the current fiscal year. So just as a reminder, ICANN has a fiscal year that runs from July through June. So July 2018 through June 2019 is what we call our fiscal year 19. This report provides actual versus budget and actual versus last year for the first 6 months of this fiscal year. So as a high-level snapshot at the top left-hand side, and it's actually one slide back, please. Apologize that I'm not running the slides here. Funding of $68 million for the first 6 months. And expenses were $59 million for the first 6 months of FY19. So funding less expenses results in a net positive of $9 million for the first 6 months, or a net excess of $9 million. This is then compared to our FY19 year-to-date budget, so again, first 6 months against 6 months, where we could just show you that funding is tracking. So the funding of $68 million as compared to $67 million is tracking, but the expenses are far lower for the first 6 months. So $59 million in expenses as compared to $65 million. So there is a lower expenses of approximately $6 million. And that results in the net excess of $9 million as compared to $2 million on the budgeted data, and that shows a positive variance against budget of $7 million. Just like to highlight that the FY19 column, again on the left-hand side, can be compared against the same period for 6 months last year of FY18. So you can see that the current 6 months for FY19, funding is ahead by $3 million, and expenses are tracking just on par to the same time last year at $59 million. That gives you an update of the FY19 year-to-date. Just highlight that we break out at the bottom of the slide the expenses as it pertains to the IANA services, which is the PTI IANA services, as additional information. And then at the bottom of this slide, we have the link to where we do post our quarterly financial statements. Moving ahead to the next slide, this gives a view of funding versus budget for the first 6 months. Again, actual funding of $68 million is then broken out here by the various funding components, where we have on the left-hand side the registry transaction fees, which are right at budget at $27 million, the registrar transaction fees at $17 million for the first 6 months of FY19, registry fixed fees, $15 million, again on par with the budget and last year, and registrar other fees, which would be the annual accreditation fees, the variable registrar fees, and any application fees. We're at $7 million on a year-to-date basis for the first 6 months, and that is comparable to budget, also at $7 million. And then the other category, which includes contributions such as the CCTLDs, the RIR, etc., and that is on budget at $2 million. The next slide is year-to-date for our expenses, and I think if we just advance the slides to that slide, thank you, number 7. This gives a snapshot of the breakout of the actual expenses year-to-date, FY19 of $59 million, into the cost categories that we report on and track. So the first cost category on the left-hand side is personnel. So out of the actual $59 million for 6 months, we had personnel at $35 million, and that is lower than budget of $38 million due to lower number of headcount than budgeted. The next category is travel and meetings, which is right on budget for the first 6 months at $7 million. Then we have professional services, also on budget at $11 million for the first 6 months. The next cost category is our administration, and that is lower than budget. We have actuals at $7 million as compared to $9 million. And then the very last category is capital expenses, and this would be cash capital expenses, and those are under budget. With nominal spending in the first 6 months. Oh, yes, questions?
Well, we can open one question. Okay, these big blocks are clear. The question is related to professional services. So whether over the years, the content of that, you know, what is allocated to the professional services has been varied? Is there something came in addition to former years, or because that is just a big block, you can interpret whatever you like. So my question is, did it vary? What is all in that? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. So professional services would be payments to vendors, and they've been consistent over the past several years. Professional services would the firms that are hired to perform a particular function or a particular project. So from the finance standpoint, the type of professional services in our department relate to audit firms and tax firms. From our other departments, it would be vendors that provide either studies or activities as it relates to the ICANN org functions. And it has been consistent. The categories are not changing, if that's your question.
Just a quick compliment to that. Specifically this year, while we are at budget, Becky didn't have a chance to comment on that yet, but while we're at budget on professional services, we have a number of categories that are lower than budget and one that is higher than budget. The one that is higher than budget is legal fees, because we had not a little bit intentionally budgeted for a large amount of legal advice on GDPR. And this is an area that has driven a lot of legal activity, as you all know. And that's the part of our professional services that is higher than we originally intended, knowing that we had a very basic level of legal fee budget in this fiscal year that was not encompassing the few subjects that have triggered more spend there. Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn Cade. So, for example, if you, legal fees you mentioned, but if you had to retain other kinds of expertise, and I'm just thinking, for example, for the auction proceeds work, so any kind of specialized expert that you have to retain for consulting. But we wouldn't see, if you were retaining contractors to do policy support work, would that also come in that category?
Yes.
Okay, so if we could move to the next slide. This is the last slide in this section as it relates to funds under management. One back, thank you very much. So this gives a snapshot of the funds under management for FY19 at the end of December. On the left-hand side, we have two charts comparing the ICANN operations, which includes the operating fund and the reserve fund. The comparison here is quarter over quarter. So the most left-hand side is our September 30th, 2018 funds under management totaling 100 million. On the right-hand side, we have the December 31st or the end of December, 131 million. This is comprised of the operating fund for 26 million. That would be cash on hand for operations. It represents normally 3 months of operating expenses. And then we have the reserve fund at 105 million. At the end of December, we have a footnote indicating that the reserve fund reflects a $36 million transfer from auction proceeds into the reserve fund prior to the end of December. And this was part of the board approved reserve fund replenishment strategy, which authorized a transfer from the auction proceeds into the reserve fund. On the right-hand side of the slide, we have funds under management for the new GTLD program-related funds. Again, it's September 30th as compared to December. And you can see that the total December on the right-hand side is 322 million. And that's comprised of the new GTLD funds of 118 million, and that represents the application fees collected upfront for the new GTLD program, which then is reduced on an ongoing basis for expenses as it relates to the first round of the new GTLD program, which is still ongoing. And the dark blue box is the auction proceeds. And again, we have the footnote noting that the 205 million of auction proceeds is after a transfer out of 36 million as part of the reserve fund replenishment strategy. It's 36 million that was transferred.
Figure show 34 to be exact.
Yes, the The graph here shows the balance that we have in the investment accounts. There's other elements that impact that balance, returns on investments, fees, and so on. So it's the difference is also between two different dates, right? So there's movements in between. Thank you.
Maybe that needs to be reflected in the footnotes.
Sure.
Thank you. We'll make sure to make note of that. Question?
Yeah, I'm sorry if this is a dumb question. I haven't been following this that closely, but is there a plan to replenish the auction proceeds back into that over time? Because I thought those weren't supposed to be touched until the community decided what to do with those.
Thank you for the question. The board decision on the topic does not suggest to replenish the auction proceeds. The strategy of replenishment specified that the reserve fund that is depleted, so the reason why there is that replenishment from auction proceeds and from annual contributions from the ICANN organization's annual budget is because the reserve fund was depleted, right? And very much below its target level of 12 months, minimum 12 months of operating expenses. It was about at 6 months of operating expenses, so half of it. So the replenishment has occurred from auction proceeds. And the auction proceeds working group, CCWG on auction proceeds, is, to your point, developing the mechanism as per which the auction funds would be distributed. Not the use of it, but the mechanisms used to determine how the auction proceeds would be used. And you have colleagues very close to you who can explain further the topic. So the auction funds, the board has made a purposeful decision to say some of that, it's important that the reserve fund can be replenished. There is that money available for the fiduciary duties of the organization to be replenishing its reserve fund, and has considered that as a priority. The other element, which is not part of your question, but just to be clear, the other element of the replenishment strategy of the reserve fund is for the ICANN organization to generate on an annual basis an excess, so that little excess can then be allocated to the reserve fund. But there's no specific intent of replenishing the amount of auction proceeds that has been transferred from the reserve fund.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's advance the slides. The next section is a high-level overview of the FY20 draft budget. On this slide, we are giving a trended view of the funding and cash expenses, starting with FY17 actuals, FY18 actuals. Then we have our FY19 forecast. And on the right-hand side, we have the FY20 draft budget. Funding in the FY20 draft budget is stabilizing. And as such, that means that the funding is growing at a slower rate than in the past. And we are bringing expenses in line with that stabilization. In addition, point number two on this slide is that the draft FY20 budget assumes a $3 million excess from operations that will be used to replenish the reserve fund. And that's exactly what Xavier had just mentioned.
Thank you, Becky. Just to add on that, you can see that in the previous years, we have not budgeted for, but nonetheless had an excess after the end of the fiscal year. So we were planning to have expenses the same as funding, but what effectively happened is that we spent a bit less than what was budgeted, or we had a bit more funding than what was budgeted, which if you would zoom in on those columns, you would see that there's a bit of excess of funding. So what happens for those past years is, while it was not budgeted, we still allocated the excess to the reserve fund. So we've done that twice in the past 24 months, once for $5 million and the second time for $3 million. So there's been $8 million from original operational excess allocated to the reserve fund. Now, the last two columns on the right, as we were just talking about in responding to your question,
you can see that now we are budgeting for an excess. And that's the result of the replenishment strategy that the board approved in October. And we will continue to do that at least until we reach a replenishment that leads to the reserve fund to reach its target of 12 months of operating expenses at a minimum. If we use this as a benchmark, 12 months is 137 million. We are at 105. There's more to go. So on an annual basis, we will continue to create an excess, basically spend less than what we expect to collect, so that we have an excess at the end of the year, and that excess can then be allocated to the reserve fund. The replenishment strategy approved by the board indicates 32 million over 8 years to be allocated to the reserve fund in that manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Xavier. If we could move to the next slide, we have a high-level overview of the draft FY20 budget. On this slide, we're highlighting, as I've indicated before, that funding growth continues to stabilize, and that the funding of 140 million in the draft FY20 operating plan and budget is 2.2% above the expected FY19 forecast of 137 million. The slower growth in funding is just based on the fact that all of the new GTLDs are primarily now delegated, and the transaction volumes are stabilizing. Point number two is regarding operations headcount at ICANN, where while funding is stabilizing, the headcount being projected for FY20 is also stabilizing. It's growing at a much slower rate than previous budget submissions, and we just would like to highlight that we are expecting that the June forecast of FY19, we will have approximately 395 headcount at ICANN.org on average. And then for FY20, we have a modest 2% increase of 405 headcount, up to 405, which is 10 headcount budgeted in the next fiscal year.
Yeah, Becky, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is Jimson on the line. Well, what will really justify the increase in the headcounts? Though you made provided some feedback, maybe at the council meeting, but for the benefit of our members, maybe you could respond to this.
Thank you. So Jimson is anticipating what I was going to try to say. So thank you, Jimson, for that comment. So what I was going to address, and I'll come back specifically to your question, Jimson, is that the figures that we use on a projected basis are a bit deceiving, because what happens is that we actually are never as many people as our budget is suggesting, because we always manage under. So for example, the budget for FY19 that we're under now is suggesting that we would have a headcount of 423 people. That's what is the approved budget says. We are 388 people, right, at the end of January. It's the latest that I have in my hands. So that's basically 35 people less than what the budget is suggesting. So we show here that we are planning for a forecast of 395, which would be an addition of 7 people, which, if you ask my personal opinion, I think we're not going to manage to do, because we're going to be under that likely. The control mechanisms that we have put in place over the past few years relative to headcount are that we require the approval for any hire, including replacements. So we challenge basically any hiring, including the replacement of existing positions. And that approval requires the approval of the SVP of HR, my approval, and your own approval combined for any hiring, including replacements. So that has led us and given us the ability to actually not only grow less, but actually reduce the headcount. 15 months ago, we were 400 in the organization. So when we talk about increases, from 395 to 405, this is what I'm calling stabilization, honestly. And also because our headcount fluctuates not only, of course, with hiring, but also with departures. So when I said that we were 415 months ago and that we are 388 today, it's because there's been more departures than hiring, which is can always happen in any organization. But the fact that we are challenging every single position to be hired has led us to be able to contain growth and even slightly decrease the headcount. While, if I may say, the work continues to increase. You are all seeing that in your own ways with the number of PDPs, a number of reviews, new challenges like GDPR that we're not volumes of work that we all planned to take on, but that we had all to take on, and you have done that as well a lot. So this is putting a little bit more context around the numbers. Thank you.
Thank you. The last two points on this slide, number 3 and 4, relate to the reserve fund contribution that we discussed on the prior slides. And just highlighting that the FY20 budget includes a contribution to the reserve fund, and that's the first time a budget has been submitted with that contribution included. On to the next slide, number 12. This is just a recap of the trended forecast. So we have FY18 actuals, FY19 forecast, and the draft FY20 budget that was submitted for public comment. This provides a breakdown of the costs by category and highlighting again the increase to the net assets of $3 million being specified as a contribution to the reserve fund. In the next slide, we just have a final slide on the draft FY20 budget, where we've provided the funds under management estimates for the end of FY19 as a forecast, and then for FY20 draft budget. So again, this provides the movement in the funds under management, which includes that contribution to the reserve fund as part of the board-approved reserve fund replenishment strategy. If we go to the next slide, we're now going to provide an overview of the public comments that have been submitted for the draft FY20 operating plan and budget. And then we will also provide specific details, requesting some clarification on comments submitted for this from this group. So if we go to the next slide, I'm going to hand this over to my colleague, Shawnee, who's going to take us through this section.
Can go in a Q&A session if that's fine for you, because we have only I think 10 minutes left for the meeting itself.
Yes, I know.
It was I'll look at it for discussion on policy matters. We will go there. I was just asking to members whether there are questions that you would like to ask now on finance and the presentation that was given.
Hi, excuse me, Jennifer Gore. The IPC submitted some comments on behalf of the FY20 budget. I was just looking for a timeline in response to those comments that were submitted.
Thank you, Jennifer, for your question. FY20 staff report on public comments is scheduled to be published at the end of next week. So this is the timeline that we had published as part of the operating plan and budget timeline. We were taking this opportunity here at ICANN 64 to have engagement with the different groups and discuss the comments. And that's where, if we could just go to slide number 19, I realize that we don't have very much time, but at least slide number 19 gives a view of the comments submitted first by the business constituency, and then the next slide will give a view by the IPC. But this just gives a view of total comments submitted of 143 by approximately 18 themes, and then where the comments from the BC that were submitted how they compare with six comments and spread pretty evenly over the groups of the themes. And then the next slide gives the same view for the IPC, who submitted both on behalf of their own constituency. And on that slide there, we can see, again, out of 143 that are categorized by these categories, the IPC had 15 comments that were submitted as part of their memo, again, concentrated in funding. So if there are any other questions just regarding these comments, we'd love to take them now.
So I think also eventually we can certainly follow up with questions in case there are, if there is any members that wants to have more clarity on that. We're happy maybe to liaise with you and, you know, do it in writing or continuing the conversation also for the next meetings.
Absolutely, thank you. We were also suggesting to send, that Chantal can send the presentation, especially the slides that we have not gone over, to the group so that anyone at their leisure can look at it. And of course, as you said, we would be very happy to answer questions by email, and we want to give you as much time back as possible.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being with us today and engaging. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Claudia, this is Chantal. Just as a reminder to CSG members, Xavier and the finance team slides were circulated with the agenda earlier this morning, and they'll be posted online as well. Thank you.
Okay, so we now move to the rest of the agenda. We have 10 minutes left, and I think what we have is the open policy matters in council in particular. Tomorrow, and I'm looking at the GNSO councillors from different constituency, there will be a discussion on privacy and proxy. Marie, Scott, or anyone else that wants to jump in and give an update? Yes. Yeah, please.
I was just raising, sorry, it's Jennifer Gore. I was just raising my hand to offer to provide comments during that session with the board on the privacy proxy.
Yeah, sure. Victoria?
Thank you. Jen, I think that Claudia was asking about, you know, thoughts that we can give to council, because it's going to be on, the privacy proxy discussion is going to be on council tomorrow, I believe. So I think you had some talking points, perhaps, to share.
I do. In particular, let me just pull those up real fast. There was a letter sent from Akram back in November. And he also talked about it in the fall conference regarding the hold on privacy proxy. One of the things he mentioned was that they would look at restarting the privacy proxy post completion of phase one of EPDP. And now that we're there and the final report has been posted and the recommendations of that report do not, from my perspective, do not have a lot of conflicts as it relates to the work that the privacy proxy IRT has completed, we'd like to understand what's the mechanism or the trigger to restart the privacy proxy IRT. We noted also that the letter that Cyrus sent to the GNSO Council on March 4th talks about a little bit about resourcing and allocation, and then notes that perhaps the privacy proxy IRT should remain on hold until the EPDP work is completed. As we all know, that could take, I don't want to even say the word several years, but that could take a long period of time. So we really would like to be able to hone in and understand what the challenges or the concerns that ICANN has with restarting the privacy proxy IRT, as most of the work has already been completed. I mean, we were pretty close when the hold was put in place. So I'd like to hear from other folks in the room their thoughts about that. But I also just want to mention on the obligation of the registrars as we're going through this work with the EPDP and the uniformed access model. we want to make sure that once the information, the redacted information, hopefully once we're able to gain access to it or that information is revealed to us, we want to make sure that's as accurate as possible. Every single registrar today is on the 2013 RAA. There's no other registrars currently on the 2009 RAA any longer. And in the 2013 RAA, as most of you all know, there's a cross-field address validation requirement of the contracted party. And we want to understand what steps that staff has taken to continue to pursue that with the registrar working group, since that was also brought up during the council meeting yesterday, on Sunday, it was brought up to the GDD staff that was giving an update to the council. And from my understanding and participation in that session, there was not a response to that question.
Are there others that want to jump into discussion? Victoria.
I mean, the other thing that I'm hoping our counselors can raise with respect to the privacy proxy is that, you know, that policy was approved in 2016, I believe. We're almost 2.5 years later at this point, with no implementation. In August of last year, Cyrus had sent a letter, I believe it was to COA, saying, we're almost there, we're going to move forward, it'll be done super fast. And then in October, Akram decides to put on the brakes. And it, as I understood it then, it was just for phase one. And then now Cyrus is saying, no, we have to wait God knows when till it's done. I find that incredibly troubling when you look at, you know, everything else that's been going on with registration data generally. And I would love for the counselors to raise those concerns at council tomorrow.
Yes, Alex.
Actually, I'm Dean.
I keep you calling Alex.
But I always feel flat. Platy, I always feel flattered when you do that, so thank you. Dean Marks, for the record, just so our counselors are clear, the initial letter came from Akram saying, in response to a request from the registrar's group to slow down the implementation, that the feeling of ICANN.org was that was not necessary and it would actually be better to go towards completion of the IRT on privacy proxy. And then it was really in connection with Barcelona, either during Barcelona or right after, that Cyrus wrote the letter saying, no, we're putting it on hold and doing this complete 180-degree turn. And I think part of the, you know, part of the reason is I think there's confusion about that on some of those folks' part, that privacy proxy is completely the same as getting access to WHOIS information. And so I don't know whether there's confusion or what have you, but I as Vicky said, it's troubling because the policy was unanimously approved by both council and board. Thanks.
Susan.
Yeah, I would agree that we need to push on this. And I think last year, you know, there was this mantra out there that, oh, privacy proxy is going away because everything will be redacted. But anecdotally, that's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing registrars maybe wholesaling, just completely moving everything to privacy proxy. And at this point, we don't know if the UAM will cover that. If we end up with a UAM that says, oh, no, privacy proxy cannot be revealed through this process, that's a separate process, then what's going to happen? There's going to be a lot more proxy registrations, right? So either, you know, I think we keep pushing on this, and then, but also try to work within the UAM to include proxy registrations in that process. So it is a simplified, it's more simplified. And Jen and I had a quick conversation, but one of the oppositions the registrars had to this was the accreditation fees for the proxy accreditation. And but she was telling me actually those fees are based on costs. So I'm not sure that we can, I think maybe we could reach across the table to the registrars and you know, say, hey, we agreed you should get some relief from these costs. But if those are hard costs to ICANN, then that may not work. So Jen, is that ongoing? Was that 4,000 fee that was proposed ongoing every year, or?
Susan, thanks. This is Jennifer Gore for the record. There was a, as I recall, and I'll have to go back and look at the accreditation model, there was a fee for contracted parties, known contracted parties, registrars was one fee, and then there was another fee that was a little higher for those that were not currently accredited registrars. So there was a cost. Reduction for known contract